Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Tonight in the Creekside Room we have Peter Nash, and he will be speaking on David and Amnon, Who's Minding the Store? So let's listen in on Peter Nash.
I'm Peter Nash, sorry. And this is David and Amnon, Who's Minding the Store? One of the things that I always try to get across to my students at seminary is that the heroes of the Bible, with the exception of Jesus, were just like us. They may not have had the same technology. They may not have been able to sin as quickly as we did, or as efficiently sometimes. But they were human beings with the same kinds of doubts and hopes and faith. And this story puts David, in some people's mind, puts David in a bad light. And it's not the point here tonight. Point tonight is to look at David, this ideal king, as a person who had problems just like all of us. And one of the problems was, as we'll see today and then tomorrow at 11:40 for those who choose to come back or can make it back, one of those problems is how he dealt with his children. So let's start by looking at the story and see what happens here. And I want to ask you to watch for a couple of things. Watch for David's role, which I'll warn you is rather minor. And watch for the interaction between Amnon, the crown prince, and his half-sister Tamar. What's going on among them? Would someone start with the first six verses? Oh, I'll do it.
Can you say where we are again?
I'm sorry, 2 Samuel 13.
13?
Sometime passed, David's son Absalom had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar, and David's son Amnon fell in love with her. Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister Tamar. For she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible to Amnon to do anything to her. But Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of David's brother Shimeah. And Jonadab was a very crafty man. He said to him, "O son of the king, why are you so haggard? Morning after morning? Will you not tell me?" Amnon said to him, "I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." Jonadab said to him, "Lie down on your bed and pretend to be ill. And when your father comes to see you, say to him, 'Let my sister Tamar come and give me something to eat, and prepare the food in my sight so that I may see it and eat it from her hand.'" So Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill. And when the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, "Please let my sister Tamar come and make a couple of cakes in my sight, so that I may eat from her hand." What do you see so far?
Well, wouldn't she be his sister also?
She's a half-sister.
Half-sister.
Yeah. David had at least three wives. There was Michal, who bore no children. She was the daughter of Saul. Abigail, who was the wife of Nabal, a story that comes up also in, I'm not sure if it's 1 or 2 Samuel, I didn't look it up today. And when he dies of a heart attack, David marries her. And Bathsheba, which is a story that takes place in chapter 11 and 12, and then I think there are at least two others. I don't think any of those three is the mother of Amnon or Absalom. You have to kind of read carefully to see who the other ones are. It's clearly not Bathsheba, because her first child dies, and her second child, or the second one who's named, is Solomon. So that's the trick here, is to read kind of widely and to read in between the lines.
necessary for him to do some pretending. That's not really right, is it? Pretend is sort of like a lie.
The story is already kind of turning on itself, because in verse 2, it says Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister. And Jonadab looks at him and immediately knows that something's wrong. I mean, maybe the illness is only insomnia, but something's going on. And then the story turns and says, pretend. So it's this sort of a web being woven here, even in the telling of the story of what's really going on. You can't really see all the details in these first 6 verses anyway. Anything else come jumping out at you? One of the things that I think is the case is Tamar, as a virgin of the upper class, young woman of marriageable age of the upper class, shouldn't be alone with a man, even someone from her family. She should always be escorted. I think that's part of the deal.
And we're going to involve David, too, to get her in there, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With the royal permission, the royal decree, then she can go to this part of the household. But otherwise, apparently, it would be forbidden. What's the king's job in your mind? When you think about a king, what do you think his job is?
Govern.
The ruler of the country, or govern?
What does that involve?
Seeing that all his subjects are treated like they should be, and see what else. That everything supposedly runs smoothly. And in this case, I suppose the household rather than the whole government.
Mm-hmm. Household is the whole government is, in fact, the king's household in some sense. In some ways, the story is...
Whether they're related or not, you're saying?
Well, in Israel, they're all considered to be related. Oh. Everybody's a cousin. This is the way the...
Because there are so few people.
In part because there's so few people, but where does Israel come from? Where does the name Israel come from? Their supposed forebearer, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob's name was changed to Israel, so that they all trace their lineage back, at least in the common story of who they are, to this forebearer, Israel.
We traced ours all back. We'd all end up really related, wouldn't we?
Well, so some of us
do. But, I mean, it was a lot closer back then than...
Well, as she pointed out, the fact that there were so many fewer people.
Yeah. You know. And that was back when, generations ago, too.
You go back to the question. What is it? You said that all people should be, the king's job is to make sure that all people are treated as they should be.
Well, I could say equally, but that wasn't the way they did it in those days, nor even today.
It wasn't even the ideal back then. And today it's the ideal, we say, and for some of us anyhow. With justice, with if not equally, with some kind of equity, that you knew what was coming. There are 3 categories of people that pretty consistently come up in the laws, in the exhortation, the charge to the people in terms of justice, and that is the widow, the orphan, and the sojourner. People who don't have access to the traditional means of power, that is an adult male who is an Israelite who can speak for you in the assembly, speak on your behalf. That was one of the king's jobs, one of the ruler's jobs, to make sure that those people had a voice. It was the king was to be their voice. And sometimes I hear in traditional gospel type services that Jesus is the father to the fatherless, the husband to the husbandless, and so on. I think that comes out of this tradition. This is what God does, takes care of those who have no one to take care of them. And that's, the king is God's viceroy, God's stand-in, so to speak, on earth. Very clearly in some of the ancient Near Eastern cultures, Egypt being a prime example, but also in Assyria and Babylon, the king was elected by the god, enthroned by the god, and in Egypt was even thought to be a deity himself. There's some evidence, not strong enough for many people, but there's some evidence that this was also thought of, part of the thought in Israel. In Psalm 2, verse 7, I think, in Psalm 89, 26 and 27, and in 2 Samuel 7, where David gets the eternal covenant, there's language of adoption, language of father and son between the God of Israel and in the case of the Psalms, unnamed kings. But in 2 Samuel 7, verse 12 or 14, very clearly it's David who is being treated as God's son. I will, if you make an error, I will correct you, chastise you, so on. So the king is to be God's representative on earth and make sure that all people are treated as they should be, according, in this case, to their station in life, but as partners of God's God's covenant. And that's what David's supposed to be doing for the Israelites, I think, anyway. Any questions about that little sidebar, so to speak? Do we know who Amnon is? What it doesn't say is that he's David's firstborn son. You have to read elsewhere to find that out, and I've forgotten where that's noted.
That Solomon was his firstborn.
No, Solomon is almost his lastborn. Hold on to that for a minute. I want to tell you something interesting about how people ascend in most of the Hebrew Bible stories. Almost never is the firstborn child the one who actually becomes the important bearer of the promise. Think about David himself. Remember David's anointing? Samuel goes off to, after Saul has lost favor with God, falls out of God's grace, however, whatever the reason for that is. Samuel is told to go to the house of Jesse in Bethlehem. He goes there, and Jesse brings out the firstborn, Eliab, God says to whispers in Samuel's ear, no, that's not the one. He goes through all seven sons in order. And David's so small and the last born, they don't even talk about number seven. He's out in the field. They didn't even bring him in for this possible honor that's coming up. He's off tending the sheep. And they get through 1 through 6, and none of them has been chosen by God. And Samuel says to Jesse, isn't there another one? I know this is the right house. I've got the right address. So you must have another. And so they send out and bring David in, and the word is, this is the one. The story of Jacob and Esau. Esau is the firstborn. In this case, Jacob tricks his brother, or wheels and deals his brother out of this birthright of the firstborn to be the child of blessing. Joseph, he's the second to the last. He winds up being, after being almost murdered, thrown in this well, becomes the vizier of Egypt, and it saves the whole nation, saves the whole world, literally, by his foresight and ability to decipher dreams. And then all the older brothers, save Benjamin, who was the one who was younger than him, come and bow down to him. There's a real tradition of reversal. And one other story, we just include some women, Rachel and Leah, with Jacob. The older daughter does get married first, but she's not the favored daughter, and it's not Leah who... Leah bears the firstborn, but it's Rachel who bears Joseph and Benjamin, and Joseph is the favorite child, and the one who comes forth to save the nation. Hey, I just tell the stories the way I read them. I have three children. Turn the mic off. Anybody tells me that you don't have a favorite, I will tell you it's impossible. They may be favorites for different reasons at different times, but we all have favorites. My kids had better never hear this tape. So many scholars believe that each of these stories in which the younger child gains ascendancy over the older children or child is to, lost the word here, give credence to Solomon's ascendancy as the king, because Solomon was the babe of the family, and he wound up being king over several brothers, at least two or three of whom were dead by the time David died, but one of whom Solomon had to fight it out with, and Solomon had to have killed in order to become the king of Israel. And many people think that that's the official telling of Israel's story, with repeated occurrences of the younger brother coming up to be the golden child or the chosen child, so to speak.
Well, let me ask you a question. Probably, I don't know if there's an answer to it or not, but did the people back in those days just keep having children so that there could finally be a favorite, or how did that work? Do you know?
I don't think it was so that there would finally be a favorite. I think it was, as it continues to be that, I don't know if you read the newspapers on the way out here. I was out for 2 weeks, and so on the way back in was reading about the population control conference in Cairo last week. And in agricultural societies, pre-technological societies, where the mortality rate is high, people continue to have 7, 8, a dozen children to ensure that someone in the family will make it to maturity and then be able to take care of the parents. And this was much more common even in the States, in the when 80, 90% of our families lived on farms. One of the issues was the mortality rate. The other issue was being able to work to produce enough food to sustain the family throughout the years. And so people, it's only in the last 50 years that people have been dropping off the number of children that they've had, as more have survived. Pretty sure that the medicine, you can get rid of smallpox, you can get rid of polio, get rid of measles killing children, then it's a little safer to have one or two or three children rather than 5, 6, 7, 8, a dozen. And the controversy continues to rage. Is that a cultural necessity? Is it a religious ideal? That's one of the things about this conference in Cairo. The Muslims and the Roman Catholics look like they're going to form an alliance on religious grounds, whereas everybody else is looking at population issues and cultural and economic grounds for the sizes of families. So, well, if the king is the one, is God's viceroy, what is the crown prince's job?
Wouldn't he be the one that would be to see that everything was put into action?
He could serve that function. certainly he's in training for the kingship. He is the king in training, the preserver, creator and preserver of justice in training. He's supposed to be, you know, all those stories that you grew up with, the prince and the pauper, and all these stories where we see the prince being tutored and tutored and tutored and tutored by all these stuffy old people trying to get him ready to be the king when dad kicked off.
This is the mother.
And in some cases, the mother. Yeah, by the time you get to England, you do have some queens with some real power. Not very often in the ancient Near East, though. I think there's one case in Egypt that's acknowledged, and one case in the Hebrew Bible of a queen actually sitting on the throne and ruling. Yeah. But by the time you get to the last 500 years, in Europe, there are many queens who wield some real power. Present day England being one of them. I think she's hoping to outlive her eldest son. Although it gets bad, it seems to get worse as it goes down the line. So the point is, though, that Amnon has as his job to know the law and to preserve the law. And to use his power for those, his authority as and power as the crown prince, to protect those who don't have a voice. And we'll see in tomorrow when we look at Absalom and his attempt at overthrowing his father, that was the actual claim that he made. The king is not doing justice to all the people. Can you get justice in this king's reign? And that's, there are enough people who say no, then they're going to follow Absalom in their revolt. But Amnon isn't thinking straight here, or isn't aware of what his job is, and he decides, I think, to use his authority, his power, to get what he wants and things he needs, rather than to preserve the good of all the people. Would someone read 7 through 15, 7 through 14?
Then David sent home to Tamar, saying, "Go to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him." So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, where he was lying down, and she took dough and kneaded it and made cakes in his sight and baked the cakes. And she took the pan and emptied it out before him. But he refused to eat. And Amnon said, "Send out everyone from me." So everyone went out from him. Then Amnon said to Tamar, "Bring the food into the chamber, that I may eat from your hand." And Tamar took the cakes she had made and brought them into the chamber to Amnon, her brother. But when she brought them near him to eat, he took hold of her and said to her.
Let me ask you to stop right there. What do you make of this scene so far? What do you make of 9? Amnon said, "Send out everyone from me." What's he up to here?
Must be totally alone with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think that is? What is,
not to her good.
Not to her good. Not to anybody's good, as it turns out. What's he trying to remove when he removes everyone? Who's going to be there? Who do you figure is going to be there?
No witnesses.
He's removing all accountability for himself. Once the servants, the teachers, the tutors. Let's pretend for a minute that this is one of those old English stories. All these people who are supposed to be telling him how to prepare to be the king and what's fitting for the crown prince and what's fitting for the young, attractive daughter of the king. She should never be alone with anyone at all. And he removes all the witnesses. All accountability is gone. He's not accountable to anyone in the community at this point. And the only way he can do that is because he has the authority as the crown prince to tell everybody, where to go. No one else in the kingdom, save perhaps the king, could create a situation where he's alone with this woman. We go back a couple chapters to chapter 11, we see David do the same thing, or a similar thing with Bathsheba. Take this authority given for the sake of the whole community and use it for his own personal intention. Another thing that strikes me about this is just how sensual this passage is, and it honestly has never struck me before today. As it was being read, the idea of sitting and watching his half-sister knead the dough to make the bread and to shape it. It's a, you know, if you've made bread, it's a very sensual experience. And he's watching this happen. And from the mouth of Jonadab, and now here in the text again, he wants to be fed from her hand, which is another very sensuous experience. To have someone feed you can be very nurturing if you're really ill, but if you've been in let's just go to the movies instead of leaning on anyone's personal experience. You've seen movies where potential lovers feed one another, the with the crossing of arms with the champagne glass and giving one another the champagne. He has set her up for this very provocative scene. And there's a chance at this point that she's gonna go for it. So I stopped you in the middle of what? Middle of 11.
11, I think.
Would you continue from there?
But when she brought them near him to eat, he took hold of her and said to her, "Come lie with me, my sister." She answered him, "No, my brother, do not force me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this wanton folly. As for me, where could I carry my shame? And as for you, you would be as one of the wanton fools in Israel. Now, therefore, I pray you, speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you." But he would not listen to her, and being stronger than she, he forced her and lay with her.
Mm-hmm. This wanton thing in my translation is anything, do not do anything so vile. And wanton fools, was it? The chant?
Is wanton fools.
Wanton
fools in Israel. And as for you, you would be as one of the wanton fools in Israel.
Scoundrels in this translation, but they're both good translations. I just wanted to give you another picture. So, what does she suggest to him? What does she say when he says come?
No.
This is wanton folly. This is vile. Such a thing is not done in Israel. Now, whose job is it to know what the law is? Is it the princess? Is it her job?
No, yeah.
It's the crown prince, then the king, and the king's advisors who are supposed to know what the law is. And she's pointing out to him, we have a problem here. I'm of marriageable age, but I haven't been promised to you. There's probably an incest problem here, although we're going to talk about that in just a minute. The incest taboo between brothers and sisters is not quite so clear in the royal upper classes in Israel. It's not so clear in general, but I think it's limited. I think the ambiguity is in the upper classes, royal class. Where would I carry my shame? There'll be no place for me to go after this. I will be absolutely discredited. And as for you, Mr. Crown Prince, you're going to be like one of the guys out there hanging out on the street corner. You know, drinking cheap wine out of paper bags. Note also that he says, "Come lie with me, my sister." You know that the story tells us very clearly that this is he's aware of what he's doing. If it is calling our attention to the incest taboo that most cultures have, it's doing so very strongly. It's not enough that he's called her sister all the way through, but he can't, in the request to come into the bed, he's saying sister. Now, in many cases in the ancient Near East, familial relationships, familial names, designations of relationships are used to denote status of inferiority or superiority. So that if you're talking to an older person or someone who has more authority than you, you would call them father or mother. This is documented literally throughout the ancient Near East, in Egypt and Ugarit and Mesopotamia and in Israel. And if you're talking to someone of equal status, you'd say brother or sister, much like the more conservative churches like the Amish, those groups call each other by brother so-and-so and sister so-and-so. And if you're talking to an inferior in status or authority, you'd say my son or my daughter. So there's a possibility that this is the tone here. But since there is a genetic relationship, I think we have to at least own that there is this very strong possibility that they're pointing out an incest taboo. Now, I'm kind of waffling on the incest taboo because in Egypt, at least in the royal families, there's this confusion as in many cases, the queen is referred to as the sister of the pharaoh. And we're not clear if it's this putting them up as equals or if they're actually genetically related. And scholars argue both ways on this. We do know that in for most of Egypt's history, they were matrilineal. And so they were very loath to marry, and most of the ancient Near Eastern countries, they would marry their daughters off in political alliances. But they would almost never do that in Egypt because the line ran through the woman, and as it did in Israel for much of their time, at least in Judah in the south. So in Egypt, we have this strong example, and Egypt is very influential in the culture and politics of Israel. And in Genesis, we have two stories of Abraham giving up Sarah to two different kings for fear of his own life. And in one of those cases, he says, she's my sister. Who is this beautiful woman with you? She's my sister. Go ahead. The stories are referred to as and one time with Isaac and Rebecca that happens, and all three of those stories are referred to as matriarchs in distress. And I can understand why, although I'm not sure I'd be much braver. And the explanation is that they'll see how beautiful you are and they'll want you and they'll have me killed to obtain you, so we'll just say that you're my sister. But then later in the story it's explained, the second time it happens, it's explained that she really was half-sister, some sort of kissing cousin sort of relationship. And so he's not really lying when he says that. And that's a little fuzzy. And that seems to be what Tamar is referring to when she says, now therefore I beg you, speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you. That there is some allowance, at least at this level, for a royal marriage. Might take a couple weeks, but we'll get to this point, and it'll be better for everyone. So she's fended him off with the traditions of Israel, and she's come back around in the next sentence and said, but there's another tradition of Israel that will allow this to happen if you ask the king, you're his firstborn crown prince, he's not going to deny anything to you. Just ask and you'll get it, but don't take it this way because this will be a scandal. This will be a travesty, and both of us will be out of luck. If you do it the other way, what's going to happen?
There'd be honor to it.
Yeah. He's still in line to be the king, and
There's no shame for her.
Yeah, there's no shame for her. And what will she be?
The queen.
Yeah,
she's crown princess, or eventually the queen.
Yeah, eventually the queen. But that's not the way Amnon is thinking, and as we heard, but he wouldn't listen to her, and being stronger than she, he forced her and lay with her. What? Anything else strike you? Any questions come up here? And either what's in the text or anything that I've said. Let's go a little further, from 15 to 19. You thought it was a sad story already. It gets even sadder. Someone pick up at 15.
Then Amnon hated her with very great hatred, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. And Amnon said to her, "Arise, be gone." But she said to him, "No, my brother, for this wrong in sending me away is greater than the others which you did to me." But he would not listen to her. He called the young man who served him and said, "Put this woman out of my presence and bolt the door after her." Now she was wearing a long robe with sleeves, for thus were the virgin daughter of the king clad of old. So his servant put her out and bolted the door after her. And Tamar put ashes on her head and rent the long robe which she wore. And she laid her hand on her head and went away, crying aloud as she went.
Okay. So at the end there, she's assuming the traditional posture of mourning, ashes and torn clothing. We see it in Job. We see it when David's first child by Bathsheba dies. It's pretty standard language for someone who's in deep grief, often, usually at a death of a loved one. Again now, Tamar is the voice, not the crown prince, but the woman, the one who shouldn't have anything to do with law and proper governance and so on, is the voice of reason, the voice of forgiveness. You know, she's just been raped, and what is she saying? No, don't send me out, because that would be worse than what you've done before. Go to the king now, is the implication, and we can still make this right. You know, the Deuteronomic law is for rape is that one can make it right by paying a price and by marrying a literal cash price and by marrying the young woman. So she offers him this option after he has violated her, which is an amazing thing in my mind. I can't imagine being in that position and then offering, reaching out and offering the reconciliation to the rapist.
It should have been her that had the hatred.
And that's what one would. That's what I would expect.
Yeah.
That's what I would expect. Unfortunately, I don't think that's an uncommon occurrence that men, people, but in the case of sexual encounters, men long and long and long for an individual, and then as soon as the conquest has been accomplished, it's not so important. I think we all do that. Men and women do that in a variety of ways, but especially in cultures where a woman's virginity is valued, or a woman's sexuality is valued as more precious and more guarded than a male's, we see that happening more frequently, I think.
I would think that just because she's offered him this particular thing wouldn't necessarily mean that she didn't hate him. It was just a way to protect herself.
It's a great point. And people often do that, being victimized or in at the short end of the stick, continue to look for a way to protect themselves or to make the best of a bad situation, which often means making an alliance with the person who's wronged you. Psychologists have documented that pretty well with some sort of bank robbery or something in Stockholm, and they have called it the Stockholm Syndrome. That was one of Patty Hearst's defenses when she was kidnapped and then became part of this Symbionese Liberation Front. Yeah, That's a great point, that she didn't necessarily like the guy at this point.
But here again, she was still trying to evade the shame that she had encountered here a little farther down.
She's offering everybody a way to save face. Yeah. And she's aware of what the possibilities are, which he should have been aware of. Which he should have been aware of.
What did wearing the long robe with the sleeves, what symbol?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I always kind of, at least internally, connect that with Joseph. Not that there's any good reason for it. But this is one of those places where we call it a gloss, where the text interprets itself. Probably someone came along later, after the story was written, and said, and people are going to come, saying, people are going to come along and say, see this first part of 18, now she was wearing a long robe with sleeves, and then someone added, so maybe the parentheses should start at the semicolon in my text, for this is how the virgin daughters of kings were clothed in earlier times. And then that last part would be the gloss explaining it. It was, at one time, everybody knew how the royal daughters dressed when they were still living in the king's household, unmarried. And then maybe they changed their dress to the traditional dress of married women once they were married appropriately. But their dress would have distinguished them as unmarried daughters of the king as opposed to unmarried daughters of everyone else, I think is the point. And then the second part of 18 explains what probably had ceased to be common knowledge or ceased to be the practice. Note again, one of the things, if you read my little bio on the board there, that I'm interested in when I read the Bible is issues of power and its use and abuse and issues of family matters, and in this story they come together. He again now calls to his servant. He sent them all away so they don't know what's going on, or at least can't witness what's going on, can't testify to what's going on, and can't step in to try to correct it. Now that he's done the deed, he calls the servant and says, throw her out. Throw her out and bolt the door. And the dutiful servant comes in and throws her out and bolts the door.
Would this have been going on with other women in the system?
That's a good question. There's nothing in the text to indicate that. This, you know, if you read the story as a whole, it seems not to be the case. I mean, he is in such a state that it's taken a physical expression in his body, and Jonadab sees that and comments on it, and like one of the guys, you know, helps him figure out a way to get over, so to speak. But there's no, we can't say that it hasn't happened or won't happen again, at least for the next 3 years, as the story goes.
But he commented earlier that he loved her.
Mm-hmm.
He obviously really didn't, because then he just used her and out the door.
Yeah, interestingly, my translation, I think you all have the Revised Standard, and I'm using the New Revised Standard, and this word in Hebrew is ahav, and ahav is the usual word for love. It's one of the expressions of Yahweh's love for Israel. In a few cases, and I'm not as convinced as apparently the translators of this text in the last few years are, in a few cases it can mean lust. And this translation says he left it after, which disturbs me because it's the same word in 13:1 as it is in 13:16-15. But in 1, they translated it as love, and in 16, they translated it as lust, which I think is intellectually dishonest. But an argument can be made. Good arguments can be made, and it's necessary sometimes, in even close context, to translate the same word differently in English. I don't think this is one of the places to do it, but Phyllis Tribble, who teaches at Union Seminary in New York, has written a fairly persuasive article that a lot of people have bought into about this story, that this should be translated as lust throughout. I don't tend to agree.
Is lust too strong a word, perhaps? Rather, desire would be a better word.
Well, my concern is more with Ahab and its very clear connotations of love, which means one thing in English. Although, you know, you hear, I don't know if it, you hear people say, you know, I'm in lust. And we're much more open about these things today than we were 15, 20 years ago. Maybe the word love has changed some in the English language since I was at that stage in life. But I'm troubled by this change in the translation. Desire is certainly what's going on. Love does change. What we think is love, we find out later is not. And only we can judge. Infatuation, yeah. But boy, can try to convince somebody who's infatuated that they're not in love.
Well, it was pretty obvious, though, from the beginning of this, what he was after from this lady, his sister.
Yeah, but it's a pretty natural human state, especially for a young man, but also for a young woman. The anthropologists talk about the four Fs of basic human existence. Feeding, fighting, fleeing, and reproduction. That's a joke, the four Fs. she'll explain that later. so that it's a you know, it's absolutely basic. It's what it drives us. And, you know, for previous generations, and it's part of what drove us to marriage, that desire, because not nearly as much as people pretended, but certainly it was the common myth of at least Western culture, that was something that you did for the first time on your wedding night. Very few people pretend that anymore, but it's still part of our mythology, that there's one special person, and that's still part of what drives. And now it's more common than some sort of common goal, like, oh, well, we've decided we want to have kids. We'll drive. We'll get people to the altar. For many, many, many generations, it was the common mythology was sex comes after marriage. For many people, it did. For I'm sure as many people, it didn't. We've got her out the door in mourning. Any other questions before we go? I'm going to have about 10 minutes. I've got to speed up here a little bit. Someone pick up and take his...
First, what does rent mean? Does that mean tour? Tour?
Yeah. Someone take us from 20 through, let's just do 20 through 22 first. Would you read that for us?
Sure. And her brother Absalom said to her, "Has Amnon, your brother, been with you? And now hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this to heart." So Tamar dwelt, a desolate woman, in her brother Absalom's house. When King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. But Absalom spoke to Amnon, neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had forced his sister Tamar.
I don't understand that last bit.
Which Absalom?
Well, it says that Absalom spoke to Amnon neither good nor bad, but it goes on to say that he hated Amnon. So how come he didn't say good nor bad? Didn't like him.
I think a fairly common phrase for he could not be in this presence. Remember in the Joseph story, before Joseph tattles on his brothers, says they couldn't even say hello to him. they.
So he wouldn't say good or bad because he would speak of him, so he never existed.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Okay. How did he guess that his brother had been with Dora?
Well, she's rent her clothes. She's torn her clothes. She put ashes upon her head, and she's. Yeah. I don't know if you've ever been near an abused or raped woman. It can be a pretty
traumatic.
Yeah, traumatic for the viewer, for the one that it, fetal positions, staring into walls. You know, staring off for hours, just withdrawing from the whole world in an attempt to not do any more processing of the.
But she must have verbally told him who it was.
Not necessarily, because didn't I imagine everybody probably, or a lot of people probably knew that she went to bait for him when he was ill, and then she came away with the torn clothes and ashes on her.
The servants may have been sent away, but.
They were aware.
Yeah, servants talk, and servants. My grandparents were. My grandmother was a maid and a cook, and my grandfather was a chauffeur and butler, and they knew everything that was going on in the house that they worked in. They knew everything that was going on.
Listen, keep your mouth shut.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, that's still a very common practice among African Americans in the United States today. I am absolutely astounded, way off the subject, but I'm absolutely astounded that things people have said in my presence that I don't think they'd say in the presence of other Anglos. And it just amazes me, especially when I was in high school and college. Yeah, now that I'm a professor.
As though you didn't exist?
Yep.
That's hard.
It's interesting. It is difficult to live with. But there is this, listen and keep your mouth shut attitude until you have exactly what you need. And then you can talk. Now, there are only two rape stories in the Hebrew Bible, two rape stories as far as I know in the Bible. And the other one is Jacob's daughter. Only one of Jacob's daughters is named, as far as I remember, Dinah. And in Genesis 34, she is raped by a young man named Hamor, who's in love with her, but he wants to marry her. He wants to do exactly what's supposed to happen. Jacob finds out what happens. He's aghast, but he doesn't do anything because his 12 sons, or 10 sons at that point, I think, are off taking care of cattle, sheep, or whatever. And his word to her is, keep your peace, which has always struck me. In the two stories, the men, the father in one case, the older brother, the brother, the full brother, I'm assuming that he's an older brother, say to the woman, keep your peace. In the first story, what happens as soon as the sons come home is they get wind of this and they go off and slaughter this whole tribe, this whole clan of Shechem is the father, Hamor is the son, and it's pretty devious. Their plot is, well, you want to marry, you're fine, but Israelites, we don't marry anybody who's not circumcised. So all the men in this tribe, this clan, get circumcised. And as I think it's the second or third day, when they're lying around moaning about the pain of their circumcision, then these 12 boys and their servants come in and slaughter this whole nation. And Jacob then says, we made a deal and you shamed me, but the contrast here between the brothers who avenge this offense and the brother who says, keep your peace, and then silently fumes for 3 years, 2 years, is quite striking. And note that David, I ask you to note what David does. What does David do here?
He's very angry.
He's very angry. But
Didn't do anything.
Didn't do a thing. I want to speed ahead here.
Boys will be boys.
Yeah, boy, maybe boys will be boys. This is my beloved, my firstborn. After 2 full years, Absalom had a sheep shears at Baal Hazor, which is near Ephraim, and Absalom invited all the king's sons. Absalom came, no, who was Absalom?
It's the brother.
Brother, or half-brother.
David's son.
He's number 3 in line for the throne. This story doesn't involve number 2, and I forget if he comes up at all, but number 2 doesn't get mentioned here. Maybe dead by now for all I remember. But we've got number 1 and number 3 here now at odds with each other. So it's somewhat in Absalom's interest for Amnon to be discredited and removed from his post as crown prince and his ascension to the throne, but that doesn't happen. And he's just steaming. He's spitting nails, but he's not talking about it. 2 years later, Absalom came to the king and said, your servant has sheep shearers. Will the king and his servants please go with your servant? But the king said to Absalom, no, my son, let us not all go, or else we will be burdensome to you. In other words, Absalom has his own little compound off at Baal Hazor, and we're not going to all come here and eat up all your stuff. We'll let part of the family go. Then Absalom said, if not, please let my brother Amnon go with us. The king said, why should he go with you? But Absalom pressed him until he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. So all the king's sons are at this festival. Absalom made a feast like a king's feast. Then Absalom commanded his servants, watch when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him. Do not be afraid. Have I not myself commanded you? So when he gets himself drunk, as he does at every one of these parties, apparently, I'll give you the word, kill him. And don't be afraid. I told you myself, and I'm the king's son, is what's implied here. So the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons rose, each one mounted his mule and fled, which I would think would be a good idea at that point. If we've just knocked off the crown prince, who knows who's next? While they were on their way, the report came to David that Absalom had killed all the king's sons. Not one of them was left. The king rose, tore his garments, and lay on the ground, and all his servants who were standing with him, standing by, tore their garments. So again, this rending the garments, this posture of mourning for death or great grief. But Jonadab, son of David's brother Shimeah, said, let not my lord suppose that they have killed all the young men's sons, all the king's sons, all the young men, the king's sons. Amnon alone is dead. This has been determined by Absalom from the day Amnon raped his sister Tamar. And so Jonadab, this clever fellow that we've seen in the first part of the chapter, says, I know what's happened. Everybody came just so he could get at Amnon. He's been planning this since the day Amnon raped his sister. Now do not let my lord the king take it to heart as if all the king's sons were dead, for Amnon alone is dead. You know, you've only lost one. You've still got some more. Now what kind of consolation is this? Yeah. Marion's been teaching right brain, left brain stuff. This guy's all left brain. He may be very clever, but he does not understand the loss of a child. But Absalom fled, and when the young man who kept watch looked up, he saw many people coming from the Horonaim road by the side of the mountain. Jonadab said to the king, see, the king's sons have come, as your servant has said, so it has come about. As soon as he had finished speaking, the king's sons arrived, raised their voices, and wept, and the king and all his servants also wept very bitterly. Did David weep when Tamar was raped?